This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 23 of the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host, Elwood Jones, and joining me, of course, is the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer. Tonight is obviously your turn to choose, and you've chose to kick off 2019 with The Twins Effect.
Yeah, a most unscholarly choice.
Yes, indeed. And it's been a bit of a weird start to the year already. I mean, we're sort of mere days into the new year, and we've all just like, have been greeted with the sad news of the passing of the legendary director Ringo Lam, who is one of those directors I sort of, when I was coming up through sort of like getting into Hong Kong cinema and sort of graduating from watching sort of like kaiju movies and kung fu movies, Ringo Lam was sort of like one of those gateway directors and led to people like John Woo. And he's a director who's really worth checking out. I mean, he makes a lot of sort of heroic gunplay movies and sort of gangster movies is what he's probably best known for. And I mean, Stephen, did you have a lot of familiarity with his work at all? Or?
No, I've got to be honest. He's not a So when you prefaced it with like John Woo, I guess you know where this was going.
Yeah.
I haven't watched a lot of his films. The On Fire films, City, Prison, School. I've seen them, but compared to his whole oeuvre, I have to say I'm woefully behind.
Okay, something for the cinema shame statement this year, maybe.
Yeah, oh, cinema shame, an entire director of cinema shame.
If you've obviously still totally discovered the work of Ringo Lam, I mean, he's not only a fantastic director, but he also works a lot with Chow Yun-fat, which should obviously make him a director worth seeking out on that fact alone. And for myself, just if you're looking for like a starting point, I think first off, you're best off watching 1987 City on Fire. This is a movie which I think a lot of people know mainly because of its direct influence on Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. But when you watch the film, you realise just how different that they are, and perhaps there's like one or two scenes that mirrored in Reservoir Dogs. Here, Chow Yun-fat plays an undercover cop investigating this gang of jewel thieves. The main sort of difference between this and Reservoir Dogs is the fact you actually get to see the heist in this one, but it's where the iconic Mexican standoff sequence came from, and the scene with Chow Yun-fat running down the street was also mirrored by Tim Roth doing the same scene in Reservoir Dogs. Really great sort of thriller movie, and one that I'm certainly looking forward to covering at some point on the podcast. Next up, another Chow Yun-fat movie would be Prison on Fire, which was also followed with Prison on Fire 2. Again, Chow Yun-fat, here supported by Tony Leung Kar-fai, who are two inmates in a Hong Kong prison, and it's just basically a prison movie. You probably notice with a lot of these titles that have the word fire, and if they don't have fire in them, there's probably going to be a scene with fire in them, because Ringo Lam was sort of a little bit of a pyromaniac, we could say. That really sort of can be seen in 1992's Full Contact, which is a film we've talked about before. Again, another Chow Yun-fat starring vehicle, also starring Anthony Wong. And here, basically, Chow Yun-fat plays this criminal who's sort of like wronged by his gang and sets out to get his revenge. And from there, we sort of move on to his sort of Hollywood years, and he replaced working with Chow Yun-fat with working with Jean-Claude Van Damme. He did a bunch of movies with him, and while it can be sort of debatable because these aren't sort of like the golden era Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, I think if you want to watch one of these three movies that he did with Van Damme, I think Replicant is probably the most interesting, where it's basically Van Damme once again tapping into that I want to fight myself sort of kick that Jet Li went on with The One. He also, what Ringo Lam also did with Jackie Chan in Twin Dragons, with the two Jackie Chans. And with Replicant, we have the Jean-Claude Van Damme playing this serial killer criminal who basically has a clone made of him, who then has to hunt down the evil Jean-Claude Van Damme. So it's an interesting movie, but I don't know about yourself, Stephen, but whenever you have these sort of like actor versus themselves movies, do you ever feel that they ever sort of work, or is it just sort of like a sort of a mildly interesting hook?
I liked it in Superman 2. I'm not a huge fan of it because it's just not a riff I'm particularly into.
Yeah.
I get the idea of having one actor for the price of two. I understand that they do these things. But it is interesting that you point out that just about every martial arts star's had one, right?
I think I'm just going through my head now, and the only three that I can think of, as I said, would be Jean-Claude Van Damme, Jet Li, and Jackie Chan have done the sort of double act. Thank God Steven Seagal never did it, because, you know, one Steven Seagal's bad enough, never mind two of them. And Bruce Lee, no, he didn't live long enough for that technology.
Sammo Hung hasn't, Donnie Yen hasn't yet. As far as I know, yeah, I'm... Because he still only looks about 40, so he's probably got another 20 years left in him yet.
I'm not sure if the trend sort of died out. I think it sort of peaked with Jet Li fighting the Temple of Lees in at the end of The One. I think that was sort of like, you know, I think we've gone as far as these ego trips can really go. So,
but yeah, I agree.
But yeah, there's certainly a starting point for you if you've yet to obviously discover the work of Ringo Lam. Sadly, another legend who's sadly no longer with us, and I'm hoping that this isn't going to be enough of those years. What was it that we were looking at? Was it 2016, 2017, where it seemed that you were losing a celebrity a week?
Well, the year that started with David Bowie passing and continued getting worse and worse, didn't it?
Yeah, I'm really hoping it's not the same for sort of like Asian film.
I mean, Ringo was only in his early 60s, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So this does seem a bit before his time. But obviously he's part of a generation of that sort of golden age of Hong Kong cinema of the 80s and the 90s. You know, one of the first to go, but I suspect it's going to be another decade yet before we have the real, you know, if we're still doing this podcast, we'll have one every time, I suspect.
Yeah, I mean, he did obviously finish out his On Fire series with Sky on Fire, which is in 2016, and at the time of his death, he was working on 8 and a Half, where it was a bunch of directors, and they were each creating segments based on Hong Kong history. So whether that's actually still going to go ahead, because I mean, it's a really interesting collective of people that were working on it, because you've got An Hu, John Woo, Su Hawk, Johnny To, Sammo Hung, and Yung Woo Ping. So it's a real great collective of people there, and I really hope that they're able to finish it, just because it'd be a nice end note for his career. But I mean, Lam himself, I mean, he never used like Canto Pop in his productions. It was always very Western productions, and he was one of the few directors who went over and kind of made a career for himself. I mean, these weren't great movies he was doing, like In Hell and, as I said, Replicant, but they were certainly on the higher end of the sort of like the director video spectrum, certainly. So, but yeah, as I said, hopefully this doesn't mark a trend for the year ahead. Speaking of downers, though, we obviously spoke in the last episode about the price break on these Zatoichi box sets. And seems that both myself and Stephen have got, I don't know, how can we put this politely?
Disappointing news.
Yeah, we received some disappointing news from Amazon that they were unable to supply a stock, so unfortunately we wouldn't be getting those. So if you want to obviously donate some box set of the Zatoichi collection, it would be greatly received. And we will be throwing up on the blog a review from David, who has done some reviews for the box set. So that should be going up on the blog soon. You can obviously check out the blog, which has our full archive on there, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com. You can also find it at thatmomentin.com as well, where we are proud members of the podcast network. So, I mean, how was your sort of Christmas? I mean, did you Did Krampus bring you all you wanted in terms of your Asian cinema watching, or?
I didn't get anything for Asian cinema watching wise.
No.
No, I think I have more than enough without the Christmas having to help me out. I got some nice things. I had a nice time. Glad it's all over.
It's all back to normality now, isn't it?
It is indeed. The only thing, it hasn't come yet, but I noticed that Arrow Video have announced a Blu-ray collection of the Ring films.
Yeah.
Ring Nought, Ring and Ring 2, along with, is it Spiral?
Yeah, Spiral, the alternate take on Ring 2, really, isn't it? So.
Well, it's kind of interesting because it actually was released at the same time as Ring. But one film took off and one film didn't, even though they were like co-produced to be together. Mm. But it's a much more accurate version of the Ring 2 novel. Anyway, obviously I've got all these movies, and I'm not sure they're really going to look fantastic on Blu-ray, but you know what I'm like for an Arrow box set.
They do know how to put a nice box set together. Especially one that will only increase in value when they sell out of the initial run. So, as always, I think if you don't own the Ring box set, I would say definitely pick this up now, rather than waiting and trying to pick it up afterwards. But I think, like a lot of the box sets, these will be done as individual releases as well. Spiral's a really interesting one, because I think I'm right in saying it was a TV movie. It ended up being, well, obviously, Hideo's version of Ring 2 just went out in cinemas and was, I don't know, it was interesting but very confusing at the same time. I'm not a huge fan of Ring 2, personally, so.
No, I'm not a big fan of Ring 2 either. It doesn't really make sense compared to the first film. But
no.
You know, I do feel Nakata's a director that after he made Dark Water has seriously lost his mojo. But yeah, so there is a Spiral TV show, but the film that's in it was actually a legitimate feature release. And like I say, they were released at the same time. It's literally kind of a cinematic double header, the equivalent of a part one and a part two. But for some reason, Ring took, it just got the attention of the world. And Spiral, I think even Arrow called it the forgotten film. But it's the true sequel, and like I say, if you've read any of the novels, it's fairly accurate, even though The Ring isn't accurate to the novel of The Ring. Hey ho. And they never made one of the third novel, which is quite a good idea really, because it goes into concepts of virtual realities and things like that, and just goes somewhere else completely.
Cool. Also from Eureka, they're going to be releasing Meals on Wheels following on from the success of the Project A box set that they did and Once Upon a Time in China. So we've got more classic Jackie Chan heading your way with Meals on Wheels, which also features one of Chan's most sort of memorable fight sequence, where he fights Benny the Jet. In sort of like, I think when people talk about like Chan's best sort of fight sequences, it's one of the ones that's constantly like brought up. So another film definitely worth discussing, worth checking out, even though it does tend to get kind of overlooked. A lot of people, when they think of sort of like the classic Jackie Chan movies, they want to talk about Police Story, they want to talk about Project A, maybe like Drunken Master and Snake in the Eagle's Shadow, but they always seem to forget Meals on Wheels, and it's kind of a shame because it was really one of those popular titles when sort of Jackie Chan was sort of like having his breakout with sort of Hong Kong cinema fans. I remember sort of like when I was a kid, it was like one of those key titles that everyone sort of like really recommended, and it kind of, as the years have gone on, it's kind of seemingly been forgotten. So it's kind of nice to see it getting a little bit of a revival and a nice looking box set as well.
Yeah, I've been collecting these as they've been coming out. So we've had City Hunter recently, and like you say, the Project A box set. Also, cinema. What are they called? Are they called 88 Films?
Yes.
Have just done a couple of really strange, obscure, not particularly good Jackie Chan movies as well. But there's clearly a, is it Battle Creek Brawl, I think, is one of them. And Snake and Crane.
Okay.
I haven't picked those two up, but they're really nice box sets. But 88 films just do really, really strange films. they like go to the sort of films that no one ever thinks of. But it's quite nice that it's all being preserved and presented in really nice sets, to be honest with you.
Well, it's funny that, again, we're seeing all the Eastern, the Hong Kong Legends sort of sets all just being re-released now through different labels. Which is kind of amusing to see, because as I said, Battle Creek Brawl, all the Jackie Chan movies, they were all originally on Hong Kong Legends. Now they all seem to be getting picked up by different labels. So am I right in assuming that Hong Kong Legends is now no more?
Oh, well, I'm pretty certain that's the case, yes.
Well, while Simon obviously may not have got a lot of Asian cinema for Christmas, and, you know, I'm sorry to hear that. But, you know, you gave the world a gift, didn't you, Stephen, by deciding to branch out from this show and, you know, just show that you're not just an Asian cinema guy, and you've launched your own podcast now, looking at world cinema.
I have. So I enjoy being your sidekick here, of course, and everyone, don't worry. We're going to keep going on this. We've just been planning our 100th episode, so it's still going. But, yeah, obviously, what the guys don't know is actually all the hard work you put into this, and really, I'm just the guest that turns up regularly and adds his two penneth worth. But I was kind of interested in going through the process myself. Obviously, this is the Asian cinema place, so I didn't want to step on my own feet. But I actually like films from all over the place, not just Asia. So I thought I would put together, for a year to start with, let's see how it goes, my own podcast about, like, as you say, world cinema. It's different to this. It's scripted. It's 15, 20 minutes max. And basically each episode I visit a different country and pick a couple of films from that country, and just give my two pennies on it. And it's explained to you, maybe these are films you're worth your time, and hopefully over the year I'll get 20-25 episodes out, and you'll have sort of 50 films, or 49 considering the first episode only talked about one film, from all over the world. But yeah, it's all sort of a solo production. I'm feeling very bullish about it at the moment, because I'm obviously in that new year's resolution kind of activity mode. Let's see how I do come June.
It's always good the start of the year where you're sort of like once you get back into work mode, once you get out of like food coma mode and get back into work mode, it's great. And the fact that it's dark outside, because usually I find that the darker it gets, the stronger I feel when it comes to work. And like when we get into summer months, you just don't want to do anything. So these are like the productive months right here. It's only downhill from here. But I mean, what's the show called? That's the most important thing.
Okay, so following on from my blog, it's called the Guelo Ramblings World Tour. It's on most platforms, I think, now. Still waiting for iTunes, but it's on Spotify and on... it's all done through Anchor. If you just search for it, you will find it. So search for the Guelo Ramblings World Tour. And like I say, one of the mission statements is that it remains quite short, because whilst these podcasts, which are an hour long, 2 hours long, 3 hours long, are fine, I personally like a shorter one I can listen to on my way to work, that kind of thing, where it's not too much of an investment of your time. But we will see how it goes. I've so far visited Spain and sort of visited Iran. The next episode will be Italy, and after that Sweden, and then after that, I don't know. So any feedback, suggestions, if anybody wants to join me, they're more than welcome.
Well, that's cool. I mean, we will obviously be putting the link on the with the episode, and you can obviously find that as well by checking out the blog. The link to the podcast is all on there as well. Also, speaking of, we're on the subject of podcasts, I do also have to give a shout out to the podcast Wizard and the Bruiser, who I've been kind of binging my way through their back catalogue. Really great show, and basically they're a couple of guys who just like to talk about their favourite sort of nerdy interests, from video games and comic books and and movies and just basically anything that sort of like catches their interest. And the great thing about the show is that, especially for old nerds like myself, is that they remind me of the the head nerds when you were a kid and before these pre-internet days, and you used to go to like the comic book shop or the video store or the Games Workshop shop or wherever you happened to be at your nerdy fix, and there would always be like the head nerdy guy who's normally like a big fat guy with a beard and wearing normally all black, and he'd normally be like the funniest and the loudest guy in the store and just like command this audience with his overwhelming knowledge. And that's what these guys remind me of. It's a real throwback. It's not these, oh, look how smart I am and I know everything sort of internet nerds that we get now. These are like proper old school nerds, and that's why I really love the show. So definitely, if you're looking to add to your podcast feed and you've already listened to all the Steven shows, then definitely give Wisdom the Bruiser a check. Check them show out as well. Really great stuff on theirs. We should also mention, while we're talking about podcasts, that BuzzFeed are currently running a poll asking you to name your favorite podcast. Now, we can't nominate ourselves, or we can't nominate our friends, but you, the listeners, can choose to nominate us, hint, hint, which would be really great. And it's a great way to let those little name podcasts get a little bit of attention, which is why we've been sort of plugging our favorite podcasts on the Twitter feed and the Facebook, just because there's a lot of shows out there who just like pump hundreds and hundreds of pounds into their promotion and just like dominate all the advertising space on your podcast feeds. And we thought it would be a way to sort of like restore the balance a bit by promoting the shows that we like. So for ourselves, if you're obviously looking for recommendations for ourselves as to who we would personally put forward, because as I said, we can't vote for ourselves, but we'll happily vote for the shows that we think are cool. I'd obviously just give you a quick rundown now of shows that are worth checking out now. So pens and paper at the ready, and I would all these you can obviously find for our blog. If you go to the community section, which is on the sidebar, you can obviously see all the shows that we're into. But the real sort of main ones that we would recommend checking out, certainly for myself, I don't know if you want to chime in, Stephen, and add any more to this list as I go, but I would recommend checking out the Feminine Critique. Emily and Christine do a really great podcast, a lot of horror based stuff there, really good stuff. Obviously Vern over on Cinema Recall, he's just a one-man podcasting machine. He's just constantly churning out material, and definitely one worth checking out. If you like obscure films, then definitely the Forgotten Film Cast is worth checking out. And if you want to know all about exploding helicopters on film, then check out Exploding Helicopters podcast. And then if you like your group sort of cast, then I would definitely recommend checking out either Simplistic Reviews podcast or French Toast Sunday podcast. And of course our friends over at the Blade Looking Thieves, who basically only further your sort of monthly dose of Asian film goodness. So that was who I'd personally recommend. Stephen, is anyone you would want to throw out there for your sort of, if you're talking about your favourite podcast, anyone you particularly like listening to?
In terms of cinema, probably not so much. I think you've covered everything that I was just looking through my podcast feed, like the Blade Looking Thieves, absolutely. All our friends from that moment in gang, of course. But I don't listen to a lot of film podcasts, to be honest with you, which is strange, isn't it? I have other interests. That's what I seem to listen to podcasts about. I was just looking at mine are like sort of history and retro computer gaming, and not very many film at all.
I know, but that's the thing. When you find, it's always a good feeling when you find like a new podcast with a decent back catalogue. So if we're not talking about film stuff, that's weird. It's really good to sort of a podcast about serial killers and cryptozoology and just general weird stuff. Or if you want to listen to the Debatable podcast, I think Greg does a really great show, just putting me to shame with just how he like commands an interview from the Debatable Podcast. Definitely check him out. He doesn't actually have a feed for on Twitter, but if you look at Mr. Greggles, you can find a link there for those ones as well. But that would that's our little plug for our friends out there in podcast town. You know, give them, show them some love. You know, hit the subscribe button and definitely nominate them for the BuzzFeed podcast list. And you know, let's try and get them some much the attention, because they're doing great stuff, but perhaps don't have the funding to get as noticed as they should be.
And maybe one day we'll advertise a mattress in a box as well.
that's the dream right there. we've got great ambitions to take over that futon market.
The futon market, the shaver market, the razor blade market, and the food in a box that you have to cook yourself market. Have I covered them all? They're the main appetizers, right?
That's what we do. Basically, that's what we want to do. We just want to get like futons and mattresses and food sent to the office. That's all we need. So, but yeah. And, you know, back onto Asian cinema related topics now. It's of course time for the dark side of Asian cinema. So it's time for me to pass the stage. It's time for me to pass things over to Stephen now, who has got another tale from the dark side of Asian cinema.
The Asian film industry is like every other film industry. There are links to organised crime, suicides, murders, salacious gossip. In this occasional series, I'm going to have a look at the darker side of Asian cinema, tell you some tales about the famous names they don't always want you to hear. Today's tale is shorter than our usual episodes, a story of a young Chinese actress who only had a single leading role, a role that should have been the first step in becoming a martial arts superstar, but instead was a victim in a particularly grubby real-world story. Wing Chun is one of the better-known kung fu styles, practiced to varying degrees by such luminaries as Donnie Yen and Sammo Hung. It's the style used by Robert Downey Jr. to help him battle his addictions. Legend talks of it being created in the Qing Dynasty by a Shaolin abbess, Ngwi. Now, Ngwi was a master of many styles and the creator of several others. Legend says she came across a 15-year-old girl, a tofu seller called Yim Wing Chun, who was being forced into marriage to a criminal. Ngwi taught her an easily learned, defensively based set of skills to help her, a set of skills that did not demand great physical strength. Over the years, she built on these skills, and her style continued on down the ages. One of the most famous proponents of this style was Ip Man, made recently more famous by the Donnie Yen films and Wong Kar-wai's The Grand Master. And he had a somewhat famous student of his own, Lee Jun Fan, who most of you will probably know as Bruce Lee. Yim Wing Chun's story was clearly ripe for turning into entertainment. There are TV series from 1994 and 2006. There is, of course, the 1994 action comedy film Wing Chun, starring Michelle Yeoh in the titular role, supported by Donnie Yen and Cheng Pei-pei as Ngwi. And then we have 2010's Kung Fu Wing Chun. It's very much in the comedy genre, almost a throwback to martial arts films from a decade earlier, quite different to its contemporaries, such as those Ip Man films I was talking about, which had brought about a renewed interest in Wing Chun and therefore created a perceived need for this film. Reviews are mixed, but everyone pretty much agrees that the star, a young newcomer called Bai Jing, was the main draw. Cute and attractive, a comedic twinkle in her eye, the 26-year-old also had genuine martial arts credentials, having studied under Ip Chun, the oldest son of Ip Man, and indeed she was Ip Chun's first personal disciple. Now, up to this point, Bai Jing was little more than a supporting cast member in a bunch of forgettable TV series and movies,
but Kung Fu Wing Chun made her what should have been a bankable star. Maybe someone that could be the female lead for a new generation of female action stars that was and is severely lacking today. She was even hailed by some as the successor to Michelle Yeoh. Why didn't this happen? Well, because by early 2012, within 2 years of her big career break, Bai Jing would be dead. On February the 28th, 2012, in their high-end apartment in a swanky area of Beijing, she was stabbed to death by her husband, who then proceeded to kill himself. The whys and wherefores of this murder-suicide, however, are still muddled by rumour and scandal. She'd met her husband, successful real estate developer Zhu Chenghai, back in 2004, and they had married in 2010. Zhu had divorced his wife and invested millions of renminbi into his young wife's career. But all was not well between the two. Accounts suggest Bai Jing had seemingly been unaware of Zhu's previous marriage and the fact he had a son from that relationship. Seemingly, he'd even lied about his age. Bai Jing had complained to her friends that Zhu was both physically abusive and was a serial adulterer. But the story gets even more murky the more you hunt for details. Bai Jing apparently had a triad boyfriend, Cao Yu, and the pair had plotted to use a prostitute to trick Zhu into an affair and blackmail him out of millions of renminbi and a divorce, and even more strangely, an Audi A8. Zhu's mother had recently passed away, and this was said to have been deeply affected his mood. And the gossip was that she'd actually found out about the blackmail plot, and this had hastened her demise. Details are, I'm afraid, hard to find, especially in English. So the real truth I may never uncover. Kuai Yu was eventually jailed for 11 years for his part in the blackmail fraud plot. The irony here is that Wing Chun, the martial art that made Bai Jing famous, even if it was just for a short time, was designed to protect a woman from the physical nature of an abusive man. And whatever the base reasons, it didn't protect her from her husband.
On to our main segment now. And tonight we obviously talk about The Twins Effect. This is a film from 2003. Most noteworthy for starring the Canto pop duo The Twins. Or is it just Twins?
I think it's just Twins in capitals.
Yeah. Comprised of Gillian Chung and Charlene Choi. We shouldn't be surprised at this point, the fact that we've got a Cantopop duo making a film, because as we know, especially in like Hong Kong cinema, the fact that you can't just be like a singer or an actor, you have to wear many hats. And we see it like most prolifically through like Jackie Chan, who I think in Thunderball he sings the theme tune, he directs, he produces and stars in it. So if you can wear as many hats as possible in Hong Kong cinema, you're normally not doing too bad. So the whole sort of concept of this was that it was based around this Canto pop duo who basically play the leading roles. And here we've got the film. It's a vampire movie / goofy love story. The film itself, it follows an evil vampire duke who seeks to kill and collect the blood of the royal family of European vampires in order to become all-powerful. And the last surviving member of the family, Prince Kiziev, am I pronouncing that right?
That's as good as they're saying it.
Okay. Here played by Edison Chung, he flees to Hong Kong with his servant Prada. Most of us will be played by Anthony Wong. And so they escape to Hong Kong, and they're basically hiding out in this abandoned church. And at the same time, we've got the vampire hunter Reeve, here played by Ekin Chang, who's kind of in a bit of a slump because his last partner, who he was romantically involved with, has just been killed by vampires. So he decides to train her younger sister, Gypsy, here played by Gillian Chung, who is basically going to take on her role and help him fight the vampire duke. At the same time, Reeve's own sister, Helen, here played by Charlene Choi, is kind of like too happy with the rival Gypsy, and sees her as kind of a rival, and in a weird sort of like twist, gets involved with Kasaf, and not realizing initially that he's a vampire, but of course he's a good vampire, and that's all that matters. And ultimately, we build to Helen and Gypsy teaming up to fight the evil vampire Duke, who is played by Mickey Huddart. Is it Mikey? Is it Mickey?
I've no idea.
I don't know.
I've never heard of him or seen him before in my life.
Played by some Eurotrash. So yeah, this film's directed by Dante Lam and Donnie Yen. And it's also noteworthy for featuring a extended cameo appearance by Jackie Chan, who plays an ambulance driver. And my favourite part in the titles being that it features a special friendly appearance by Karen Mok.
Indeed, very friendly.
What the hell is a special friendly appearance?
I've no idea. This film's just bad as a box of ferrets, isn't it? And that just sums it up.
So, yeah, so Karen Mok here, it plays Ivy. So, if you're a Karen Mok fan, something to be excited about there.
She's got a great 3 minutes.
Exactly. So, Stephen, why did you choose to kick off 2019 with the twins effect?
Because I love the twins effect. I love everything about it. So you did a fabulous job there trying to describe the plot and all the characters. So it's basically a star vehicle that's got sort of Buffy-like overtones.
Yeah.
With a bunch of quite high-profile guest stars. And co-stars, Jackie Chan being the obvious one, but Karen Mok and and J.C. Ho aren't anything to sniff at. You've got some big stars of cinema in Ekin Cheng, is a big deal. I mean, a lot of people think he's very wooden, but he's a very handsome fellow and is very popular. Edison Chen at the time was a rising star of music, streetwear and acting, although as we talked about before and I will talk about again in a future episode, not such a nice guy now. And then what we have also is in Dante Lam, we have someone who's at this point in his career, he's a fairly popular director of fairly good films, is going to go on to be an international superstar. And of course, we've got Donnie Yen as, and they call it the co-director, but clearly he's the action director.
Yeah.
All in a really quite slick package, I think. I mean, the CGI isn't terrible. The fight scenes are pretty good when you think what Donnie's had to work with. And even though the pair of them, this is not either of their best acting roles, they bring what they were. I mean, I don't know if you know the twins' music. It's dreadful. It's dreadful canto pop, and canto pop's a really difficult thing to learn to love anyway.
It's also on the next mixtape, so something to look forward to there.
I mean, I've got some twin stuff, but I couldn't hum you a song. The theme song to this isn't bad, though. Jackie and the twins singing it. But it does showcase them in the sense they're two very different people. So Charlene's the sort of the cutie pixie girl type that we've talked about before, and then Gillian's the sort of they even say this in the making of, she's the attractive one. That she's bringing a different sort of audience to it. I think you call them the sweaties, right?
but they're
bringing their own individual personalities to it. Now I might talk later about what they come to, but fundamentally this film should have been a complete mess, or it could have been like one of those New Year's comedies that they like had shoving out in January and February in Hong Kong, where it's just a bunch of guest stars and it's all fairly nonsensical, and again, we might talk about some of them at a future episode. But I think it's a really solid film. It's got vampires in it. It's got a bit of romance. It's got a bit of comedy. It's got a bit of Jackie Chan. It's got some decent action. And I remember when I watched it way back when for the first time, I was utterly charmed by it. Watching it again this week for this, maybe some of the lustre has gone, but I still had an enjoyable time with it. What did you think of it?
I thought it was a lot of goofy fun. Because, yes, it is. On one hand, it is obviously like a vampire movie, and on the other hand, it's sort of like this goofy sort of love story. It's sort of like, I like you, but not really, sort of like a style movie where they're basically, there's a lot of faffing around with the two sort of main couples. Because here, obviously, Gypsy and Reeve doing their thing. And then we got Kazav and Helen who are doing their thing. So you see a lot of sort of back and forth and flirting and whatnot. And it's sort of broken up with sort of vampire slaying action. And it should be noted that these vampires like don't follow any sort of like traditional rules, essentially, because they're being run through by the main weapon of choice of both Reeve and Gypsy, which is a sword that also turns into a grappling hook. Now, in traditional vampire lore, silver can't kill vampires, but here it seems to work okay. But they don't ever seem to like use stakes and stuff. It's just basically they slash them up and then they turn to dust. And it was a little confusing, really, where the sort of vampire rules sort of fall, because obviously Eastern vampires follow a completely different set of rules to Western vampires. Western vampires, I think we all know, you know, it's steak, sunlight, garlic. And Eastern vampires are more sort of affected by elementals. And I think right off the bat, one of my recommendations for this would be rigor mortis.
Oh, yes, the modern one. Yes.
Yeah, rigor mortis, obviously, it's a sort of goes into sort of these details of what affects sort of Eastern vampires, and I think that's another film that we're probably going to cover on a future episode, because it was recommended to me and I thought it was pretty cool. So it's definitely one that I want to try and work into this season, so look out for that one. But you know, it was a lot of fun. The Jackie Chan sequences, I mean, they basically worked him in, because you know, at the time he was sort of like a really hot property, and I'm trying to remember really when he was sort of like making waves in sort of like Hollywood, because I mean, it's really sort of towards the end of the 90s really he was sort of making that sort of impact, really, wasn't it? So
it was. Now there's also two other things involved. I think he just made a film with Donnie Yen, again, if you look on the making of, which is on the DVD I've got, probably yours as well. It's clearly there's a burgeoning respect between the two.
Yeah.
Which I don't think had always been the case. I mean, Donnie Yen's not always been the super respected superstar that maybe we consider him these days. But I think he'd started proving himself as a director and an action director and shown himself to... And later on, he actually showed himself to be quite a good actor, but that's not what he was famous for at this time. He was just a martial artist on film.
Mm.
And the other thing is, do not underestimate how big twins were in 2003 in Hong Kong and in the wider Asian experience. They were the Spice Girls. Yeah. and indeed, they're still together now. Gillian's issues with Edison's activities and as part of that scandal kind of buried it a bit, and they've both forge somewhat separate careers, and Charlene is now probably just as famous for being acting in films of all sorts than her music career. But they were massive, so actually Jackie Chan himself probably would want to have been part of this. This was a big deal. This isn't their first film that they've acted in together, but it's certainly the one with the most scale and scope and high budget. Because it doesn't look like a cheap old film, does it?
Oh no, I mean, this is definitely a classy production. And I mean, when we talk about the use of CGI here, I find that when we look at Asian cinema, the use of CGI is very different than when we look at Western cinema, where CGI seems like a be there to cut corners. It never seems to have the same sort of gloss or same sort of feel that we obviously see in Eastern cinema when we look at things such as Kishen, for in a prime example, which feels like, I think it's like 85% CGI in that sequence, but it looks absolutely stunning the way it sort of blends into sort of the real life, real acting. And here again, I mean, the CGI work doesn't ever detract from it. It sort of adds to the fun here. And I mean, this is very clearly a wild work movie. So you obviously see both Charlene and Gillian doing some extraordinary things as they fly through the air and kick vampires in the face. But I mean, yes, they are perhaps not martial artists, but they're still putting across a performance which is not horrible to look at. It's still fun to see them fighting vampires. And yeah, it's an interesting movie just tonally, because as I say, it's not just a straight vampire movie, and it's not sort of like a straight romantic movie, and it just goes in some very interesting directions throughout the film. And it is just as I said at the start, this is just a lot of goofy fun. And I can understand, I mean, Jackie Chan at the time, he's 2003, so he's sort of coming to the end of his sort of Hollywood prime sort of years, because he's doing stuff like The Tuxedo and The Medallion in Hollywood, and he sort of comes back to do, like, to Hong Kong, and he's sort of like, you know, there's still this incredibly big name. I mean, he's still got this legendary status in Hong Kong, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he's the local boy done good. I mean, this is before he became a tit and mouthpiece for the Chinese Communist Party. But that's, again, story for another day. But at this time, you know, he's at the peak of his fame internationally. That's why there's a UK DVD of it. I can promise you it's not because of Charlene and Gillian. it's because there's a Jackie Chan cameo in it, for sure.
Oh yeah, and I mean, it's so amusing when you see his sort of like standout sequence here, because obviously he does some light comedic work where he's getting married, and they do some light comedic work there, and then we have his sort of big standout stunt sequence, which is a ambulance chase, where you have these two vampires sort of pursuing him on motorcycles. And it's really funny when you look at the scene, you can see the scenes where the ambulance clearly isn't moving, and then the scene, you contrast it with the scenes where, like, Chan's hanging out the side of the ambulance and doing his bit. So it's kind of amusing to see the contrast in sequences there.
Indeed. I also, sorry, we were talking about the stars, you know, like Karen Brooks, 3 minutes. She's very entertaining in it, and she's in that sort of comedy sequence, isn't she, at this wedding. I forgot Chapman Toe is in it at the beginning as Helen's ex-boyfriend. So Chapman Toe might not be a name that everybody knows, but he's one of those faces that's in just about every single Hong Kong film made since the year 2000. And he's like a Hong Kong celebrity. So he's not just an actor, but he's like a comedian, a radio host. So again, there's another famous face. And of course, the one I did forget, which you did mention, is Anthony Wong, who is one of those people you can just put into any film and he makes it better. He plays this it's sort of an advisor to Kazaf, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he's his right-hand man. And I mean, this is a rare good guy role for Anthony Wong. And Anthony Wong is awesome in everything. That's all you need to know about Anthony Wong. He's never bad. And here he's mainly there for the comedic relief in this one. And I think every scene he's in is just really, really funny. There's a scene where Kazav is trying to find he arranges to go on a date with Helen, but he mixes up the time, so he arranges it for midday rather than midnight. And they're trying to come up with this bomb, and he's sort of like mixing all these, actually one's like mixing all these like ingredients together, and he's sort of like, oh yeah, be ready in like 20 years, because we've got to leave it on the sun to get it incredibly potent. And
I think he says 300 years, doesn't he?
Oh yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's very dry, he's very detached and aloof, but there's a wink of his eye and a sparkle going on. And there's a fantastic bit. Have you seen in the final credits where there's the bit where he's with the the estate agent.
It's so bizarre, the end credits this movie, because it's just basically deleted scenes from the film and Jackie Chan's usual outtakes. And it's not like, the only other film I've seen this sort of done where they've included the deleted scenes is in the end of Godzilla Final Wars, where you get all the deleted scenes.
You do. But again, it's all sort of part of the package. It's just that final, it's really funny. And it would have worked in the film, and I believe in the original Hong Kong Cop, that is part of the film. But yeah, he's trying to suck the blood of this girl, and he can't get his teeth out.
He gets basically, he has vampire impotence.
He gets vampire impotence, and then they just turn it around, and it's sort of playing on the whole vampire as sexy, you know, thing that Twilight would do a few years later. She turns around and sort of basically says, "Oh, you always like this. You'd be my first." And it's just a gloriously brilliant scene that stands up on its own. And you think, why did they cut that?
I know what you're saying. And I mean, they have that really great scene as well where they're talking about, where he's like questioning why he wants to date human women. He's like, why don't you date vampire women? All you need to do is raise your hand and they're there. But yeah, Anthony Wong is just one of those enigmas of Hong Kong cinema. I mean, the fact that he can play the most horrible villainous roles, and then at the same time you can have him play these really comedic roles like we're seeing here. And it's so bizarre. I mean, the whole time I'm like watching it, and the performance he gives here is very similar to sort of like the comedic roles of like Gene Reno. Mm-hmm. It's that sort of very sort of that's the sort of style performance he's given here. And but he was definitely a highlight for myself. I think every time he was on the screen, it was just a bit of joy.
I mean, he's one of my favourite actors, period. But to see him having a bit of fun here as well is nice, because I think Jean Reno's a very good example, because you know they're both not exactly blessed with great looks, and you know the way they look would align them to bad, evil roles, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And in fact, Anthony Wong has complained about this, because Anthony Wong's actually half white. He's Welsh. I think his dad or his mother is Welsh, which is why he appears in ITV dramas sometimes.
Just the once. It's not like he's made a career out of ITV dramas.
He's been in some British films as well. Anyway. And I think he really struggled, and he thought, you know, a lot of it was because he was a half caste, and also maybe this, you know, he hasn't been blessed with fantastic looks. But it's fantastic that both him and Jean Reno have been able to sort of kind of turn it around and actually turn themselves into cuddly, more heroic types. I mean, he's not actually heroic in this film, is he? I think he'd quite like to go back to the old way of drinking blood, but his new age king is driving him in another direction.
Yeah, now the whole sequence where we have Helen meet Kazaf in the restaurant, and as you mentioned already, we've got Chapman Toe here as a bold ex-boyfriend, and he's there with his latest squeeze. It's such a random scene that they're in, the fact that she has like this bizarre list of circumstances which he can leave her. And at the same time she's challenging him to cut off a small part of himself in order for him to be released from this romantic contract that he apparently was under. So, but again, there's some really great physical commentary there from both Anthony Wong and Edkin Chang. Oh, is it? No, Edison Chan.
Yeah, Edison. And but there's some weird shit in there as well, isn't there? Because...
Well, this is the thing I was questioning. I mean, is how much is lost in translation here?
Because he compares Charlene to the new girl, and they have a different view of what's acceptable to be said, I think, in Hong Kong. I think we know this. I think we've talked about it before.
Yeah.
But he basically says, her breasts are bigger than yours. And then he says, you're thick in places she isn't. Now, there might be things wrong with Charlene Choi. Right, you might not like the way she looks, you might find her personality annoying, but the one thing is, there's not an ounce of fat on that girl. There can be no possible place where she's thick. And it's like, What a weird thing to say. But it's a little, it's not very PC, is it? But you get a lot of that in this era of Hong Kong cinema where, I mean, you get, it's not in this film, but, you know, you'll get comedies which have rape jokes in it. And you think, was that ever funny?
Well, I think we've constantly addressed the fact of things being lost in translation, especially when it comes to humour. When we look at the classic and the etiquette of fart humour South Korea. Classic
fart humour, poo humour, yeah, absolutely.
And it's, again, we see that sort of lower and more crass sort of humour here, but as you were saying, in South Korea it's sort of seen as a higher level of comedy. I mean, obviously, speaking of sort of ostracized actors because of their heritage or ethnicity, this film really should be noted for the amount of work it's given to white martial artists here who are basically cast as your trash vampires. So, I mean, we've got people like Bay Logan here, we've got Mark Strange, you've got Matthew Sturgis, Philip Ning, Don Ferguson. So, we've got these. All these sort of like white martial artists who are sort of drafted in to play these European vampires here. And I mean, how did you find the sort of European vampires here? Because I mean, every time they're on the screen, they always seem to, when they're not fighting, they always seem to line up like they're going to burst into a big dance routine or something.
Yeah, are we allowed to sort of say Bay Logan's in it anymore? I didn't know if he was a persona non grata these days.
Should we address the amount of scandal that is attached to this movie? I mean, you obviously mentioned already we got Gillian Chung, who was caught up in two photo scandals, really, hasn't she now? So
she had. So there was one where somebody took a photo of her in a changing room, which is wrong. You know, she didn't do anything wrong there. Well, she didn't do anything wrong, full stop. But then, of course, we have Edison Chen's the nude photos of not just with her, but with various Hong Kong actresses and singers, and a couple of Taiwanese ones as well, I think, that caused a great debate in Hong Kong, both against... basically killed Edison's career.
Yeah.
Dead. It caused great shame to the females involved, including the ones that were married. But I think Gillian probably suffered more than anybody.
She obviously had, at this point, she has this image of this sort of squeaky clean pop star. And this is like the second time that she's been photographed in a compromising position. She publicly apologised for being naive and silly. And her subsequent television appearance on Jade Solid Gold apparently received over 500 complaints to TVB. And while the Hong Kong Broadcasting Authority received over 1,200, leading to various promotions to be cancelled. I mean, she was supposed to be performing as part of the 2008 Summer Olympics opening, but Zhang Zimo dropped her. She basically just had this huge knock-on effect on her career.
Yeah, and it took a few years for her to recover. I mean, Twins eventually got back together. She's still acting now. She's done some solo albums. Twins are still going. I think it's been a couple of years now since their last album, but, you know, they're still a thing. But it also opened up... So I think she suffered much more than Cecilia Chung and the others suffered. But it also opened up a huge debate in Hong Kong about privacy laws, about the scandal rags. So I think I talked in the Anita Mui episode of Dark Tales about how these film and television celebrity magazines hounded her. And it opened up a debate in Hong Kong about privacy and paparazzi and things like that. And you do wonder if this had been in the West. Well, we kind of had it, didn't we, with the iCloud hacks. That it hasn't really hurt Jennifer Lawrence at all, has it? Having similar photos put out.
I think, so,
yeah. It's a different standard, a different cultural acceptance, a different time, maybe.
It also depends on who you are. Because there are obviously many examples with Western celebrities having photos leaked. I mean, we had the whole photo hacking scandal. I mean, Vanessa Hudgens, who was obviously under contract for the House of Mouse and Disney, she, when that sort of came out, they were like looking at cancelling her contract, but it was only because of the success of High School Musical that she still kept her job. So I think it really depends on who you are and how important you are to the film industry, whether you your career is able to withstand it or not. Because but as I said, when it comes to sort of like the Eastern actors and that, it's as you were saying, it's a completely different sort of field over there, because they're very sort of sensitive to sort of nudity and pornography and things like that. So it's seen a lot more serious, I'm right in saying.
I think so. And we've also got to remember, in Gillian's case, what she was part of. She was part of Twins. Twins was a band, not a band, it's a couple of girls singing. Their main fan base is going to be younger people,
yeah.
Young girls. They're very much trading as Girls Next Door. So if you've seen any of their earlier films, they're very much trading on this Girl Next Door kind of image, wholesome. And nude photos having sex with Edison Chen doesn't really fit that image. But I do feel, you know, I do feel she was the one that really suffered. Edison obviously suffered, but as I will talk about in a future episode, this is but one of many scandals related to Edison Chen.
I mean, should we quickly go over his many? Because, I mean, this is 2003, and he celebrates the success of this movie. Because, I mean, this was a hit in its native Hong Kong.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, I mean, he's I think he's actually his English is superb. I think he was actually born in Canada. but yeah, he's a Hong Kong Canadian. So is Charlene Choi, actually. So there's a lot of crossover there between Hong Kong and Canada, because a lot of Hong Kongians go to Canada for reasons.
So yeah, first of his many incidents, as Steven pointed out already, we've got the 2004 assault incident, where two teenagers mocked Chen with dance moves outside a record store, basically got into a scuffle with them. So yeah, that wasn't a good start. And then 2007 we have the taxi incident, where he got into an argument with a taxi driver. Yeah, so in 2008 we've obviously got the sex photo scandal coming out here. So I can't imagine that that really did wonders for his career either. I mean, is it sort of different for male performers than it is for female performers?
It destroyed his career. He had to restart, but that might have destroyed his career, but it doesn't stop his actions, does it? So if I can take over.
Yeah.
In 2011, there's another photo scandal, and this is even worse, because it's with a 16-year-old. I'm not sure what the age of consent was, but he wasn't 16. And, I don't think they were nude photos, but they are...
No, it's sort of like
intimate photos.
It's they found out that he had been messaging her, asking her to pose in both swimsuits and school uniforms. Now there was no new photos, as you said already, and it's a 16-year-old Hong Kong model, Cammy Tees, and
yep.
There's a lot of there's a whole rabbit hole of bad stuff that attached to that one, so.
Yeah, and then in 2014, he's got another girlfriend, and some fan came up and said, "Oh, look, it's Edison. He's still got some fans." And while she was taking a picture of him, he stuck his middle finger up at her. it's just not what you do, you know, if you're trying to recreate your career. And then, I think we've got more.
Yeah,
yeah.
Still
and
going.
Then in 2015, he... got into a fight at Shanghai Airport because someone cut in front of him. Now, finally, he's done something which I can agree with.
Yeah.
Because people at airports, all sense of decorum and standards do seem to disappear, especially when you're trying to board an aeroplane. So, well done, Edison. beating somebody up who cut in line, I'm not too bad about, but he didn't get charged for it. And then, the most ridiculous one of all, really. So Lin Chi-ling is quite a famous Taiwanese actress. And for some reason on Weibo, which is like the Chinese version of Twitter, he made several posts saying that what she looked like, how she smelt, and what she'd done to become a celebrity. All down to the latest Chinese girlfriend, a supermodel no doubt, didn't like her very much. Yeah, I mean, the guy's a slimy bit of filth. I see very few things other than the beating the person up at the airport, which is good. Although, to be fair, if you ever watch Edmund Pang's Trivial Matters, which is sort of a... quite an early film from Edmund Pang. It's a sort of a lots of little tiny skits and segments. It's well worth seeing. He does play in it a really repulsive reptile of a human being, and you kind of think he's kind of saying, yeah, this is the me that you know. And so he has that element of self-awareness, maybe.
Well, he just sort of brings it upon himself. I mean, if we look at the whole Chai Ling sort of case, the fact is that he chooses to respond to the threat of legal action by posting on Weibo, "Woo, that was a close call. Think about what happened in the past few days and ask yourself, why don't they just sue me?" You don't ask people to sue you.
It's almost Trumpian, isn't it? It's amazing. Now, to be fair, I do believe he's kind of calmed down a bit. So I think he's got married.
Because he's got nothing left. I think there's no more bridges to burn.
I think actually his music career is also taking off again a bit. And he's in a film next year, or this year. This is 2019, isn't it?
Yep, 2019.
So they're doing a sequel to Initial D, which is it's probably probably his most famous film that he was in, actually, to be fair. So he is maybe coming back, but I've been very lucky at Eastern Kicks to meet a lot of directors and actors and actresses, and I can honestly tell you, without exception, they've all been lovely. Just really nice, humble, genuine human beings. You can even look at I keep talking about the DVD extra. There's an interview with Yi Kin Cheng, who's a man who has been pilloried in the press for just being good looking and nothing else. So he's not meant to, you know, he has some wooden roles. And also his wife, Ji Ji Leung, is very famous. It's almost as if he's famous just because he's good looking. But the guy is so humble and so self-effacing. And that is just what you expect these people to be like. And I think they genuinely are. And Edison is just the opposite of that. He's like this hot-headed, repulsive person. I mean, how old is the guy? Late 30s.
Let's see, Edison Chang, he is born... He's 38. He's 1980, he was born. So.
Yeah. So, grow up, dude. Please.
But, I mean, this is a man who wears a lot of hats again. He's an actor, rapper, singer, songwriter, producer, entrepreneur, artist, and fashion designer.
Indeed. And, I mean, like I say, we'll be talking a bit about him again sometime. He's got an interesting body of work. Oh, yeah, but I saw somewhere, I was watching a documentary about him on YouTube, and they called him rapper, actor, and streetwear idol.
What's a streetwear idol?
I think it's a man who wears tracksuits in public, but okay. I could be wrong.
Well, looking at his Wikipedia page, he's really happy with that shoe.
He is indeed. But yeah, I mean, the shame is that he came to prominence at a time where Hong Kong and Chinese cinema as a wider piece was looking for those next names. Everything comes in fours, doesn't it, with in China. So, you know, we're coming to the end of the last before the Andy Lau, the Leon Lei and that lot. You know, we're looking for who are the young new faces. And you've got obvious people like Sean Yu, who you'll see in thousands of films at this age. And Edison could have been part of that. So like you said, he's got lots of hats on. He's a good-looking fellow. He's you know, actually, he seems to be quite charming and funny. So, you know, there's plenty of opportunity for him here. And he blew it. You know, he blew it in a big way. And in a way, that's almost the tragedy because, you know, because of what he could have been. But no, not a fan.
Have we got anything else to say about Twins Effect?
Oh, I think we've moved on from Twins Effect. Okay. However, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
For what definitely. It is. It is not, and you know, it's one of those times where I'm not bringing you down an art house rabbit hole. I'm not challenging anybody in any way. I honestly think it's just a genuinely good, fun film. And actually, in parts, I mean, like the opening sequence on the subway train, it's bloody brilliant. You know, it's a Buffy stroke Blade kind of thing going on.
Yeah, definitely.
And if you can handle that, and you can handle the fact that it will go off into a funny little romantic comedy, and it's a bit Hong Kongian in the way it's set up, I think it's hugely entertaining. And for a vehicle for a pop group, it's unprecedented. It's better than the Spice Girls movie, right?
It could be worse than the Spice Girls movie.
But yeah.
I mean, you know, it perhaps is a little over excessive in its use of slow motion. But yeah, it's definitely fun. I mean, as you said already,
John Woo, come on.
No, John Woo's use of slow motion is completely different than this. This is the fact that we've got someone do a kick, and you can go off making a cup of tea and come back, and they still haven't landed it.
Yeah, it's just maybe because they're not very good at it, mate, and they're trying to hide it.
People magically flying for the air. Yeah, it's some very goofy fun. It's not the most groundbreaking film that you'll see, but it is a lot of fun to watch. It was followed up with The Twins Effect 2, which has got a completely different story.
And it is dreadful.
Okay.
It is. It is dreadful.
You're saying a film that stars Donnie Yen, Wilson Chen, Fan Bing Bing, Jin Chin, Jackie Chan, and his son JC Chan, as well as Tony Lung Car Fei, can be
if
awful.
If you want to watch it for stargazing, fine.
Yeah,
but it is. I remember I wrote the review for it on my blog years ago, and I couldn't find words, so I just used like when you have the fake Latin that you put in when you do typesetting to get the shape of a page right. No, literally, episode. I just pasted a load of that in because that's the only way I could make sense of it. So yeah, watch it with the sound turned down. Say, hey, look, there's little Tony, there's Donnie Yen, and leave it at that. There's actually a third film called Twins Mission, which is, I can't even remember how bad it is. So it's probably not as bad as the second one, but it's not as good as this one.
So for reviewing, if you want to watch something better than the sequel, what do you recommend?
Okay, so actually what I'd gone for two films, and also one not to watch.
Okay.
But you've already picked the one not to watch, which is the sequel.
Right.
So Charlene Choi actually has gone on to do some really good stuff, and now she's in the film that we've just talked about, and in her earlier film, she was very much playing on the cutesy girl next door, the pixie dream girl thing, can be a bit annoying, but she's taken more and more challenging roles. She still does the cutesy stuff, she still does the comedies and things like that. In fact, I'm going to suggest a whole bunch of films. She certainly formed a relationship with Yi Kin Cheng, and they did the My Wife is 18 and its sequel, where Yi Kin Chen, who's actually in his 40s, marries her. I think we've talked about it before, actually. But it's really good. But that's not the film I'm choosing. The film I'm choosing is Oxide Pang's Diary. So Oxide Pang is one of the brothers, the Pang brothers, who made The Eye. Diary is this sort of psychological thriller. She plays the main role. Sean Yu, who I've already talked about, is in it. And basically, it's about a girl with a mental illness. It's one of the best Pang Brothers films outside of The Eye, because they did do good films other than The Eye, regardless of what anyone tells you. if you can track that down, it's really, really good and might be a film I might bring to another episode. Gillian, bless her, isn't the world's greatest actress. She's quite wooden. She's been in a lot of films, but you will not find a film where it says, gosh, Gillian's acting was brilliant in it, with one notable exception. I talked about Edmund Pang a bit earlier, or Pang Ho Chung as he's known locally. 2004's Beyond Our Ken. It's a drama. This is 2004, not 2008 when I start describing it. She gets dumped by her boyfriend Daniel Wu, and then finds out that Daniel Wu's uploaded nude photos of her to a website. This is life imitating, art imitating life before life has even happened. But it's a really solid drama. Gillian's really good in it. She's been in a couple of Edmund Pang's films, and he seems to be able to get the best out of her. So it's fantastic because of how it echoes what is going to happen in the future, but it's a really good drama and really worth tracking down. So yeah, Diary and Beyond Our Ken.
Fantastic. For myself, I think we mentioned already, Rigor Mortis from 2015. This is a film directed by
Juno Mack. Yeah.
And starring Anthony Chan, who is, for myself, best known for starring in Kindergarten Ninja. The film itself is a real sort of throwback to my other recommendation, which is Mr. Vampire. And basically, he's a washed-up movie star going to an abandoned apartment block to end his life, only to find himself plunged into a dark storm of supernatural chaos as ghosts, vampires, and zombies erupt out the housing block, plunging the residents into an apocalyptic fight for their lives. You can currently get this on Amazon Prime, and I believe it's on Shudder as well. So it is one of the easier ones to get hold of, and definitely one that I've heard people highly recommend it to myself, and it's one that I really got a kick out of. Mr. Vampire, a classic throwback to sort of my early days of getting into Hong Kong cinema. This one's from 1985, directed by Ricky Lowe, and it's noteworthy because, I mean, it features hopping vampires, which are sort of like one of those key staples of Eastern vampire movies, and something that, you know, it just works. And when you try to explain like Eastern vampire movies to me, do you have a problem trying to explain why they hop?
I always consider, God, Mr. Vampire, I think, was one of the first Hong Kong films I ever saw, back way before I knew I liked Asian cinema, when I was a kid. So it's always been a very special film to me. But I've always considered what we call the Eastern vampire is more like a zombie. And therefore they hop because their bodies are dead and they can't move their limbs or something like that. They're not really vampires, are they? In the way that
not in a traditional sort of sense. But yeah. I mean, obviously Ricky Lau would go on to direct multiple sequels for the series. He also directed Close Encounters of the Spooky Kind 2, and Where's Officer Chuba? If you want a really random deep dive into Sammo Hung's career, which I think is kind of worth checking out just for that name alone. But those were what we'd obviously recommend for this one. A fine selection to kick off 2019, Stephen, so thank you for that one.
Pleasure as always.
So this brings us to the end of another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club. We hope you've enjoyed listening as always. You can obviously follow us both on Facebook and Twitter. We are on Twitter, it's at AC Film Club. And of course you can check out our blog, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com, where you can find not only a complete archive of episodes, but you can also find the transcripts for Stephen's Dark Side of Asian Cinema. You can find anime reviews. We've got some film reviews up there as well from David Brook, a Blueprint Review. And we also have the mixtapes, where each month we put together the sort of songs that have been rattling around our head with team member Steph. And Yeah, we try to expand on what we obviously do on the show already, so definitely plenty of things to check out there. You can also check us out on thatmomentin.com, as well as the other great shows on the podcast network there as well. So if you, wherever you happen to be listening to us, you know, give us a like, give us a rating, and give us some feedback, as you know, it really helps us to promote the show, you know, way more than like all the gold and at the end of the rainbow. Just even a rating or some feedback really just helps raises the profile of the show that little bit more, and we appreciate all of you have been obviously supporting the show so far. On the next episode though, we will be having a special guest, as we're going to be joined by Kim Lo of Tranquil Dreams and Game Warp fame, as well as Movies and Tea. And she's going to be obviously joining us to discuss the film The Bullet Vanishes, which is going to be super exciting. And we will also be revealing the very special show we've got planned for episode 25. So all that's coming up on the next episode. But until next time, I'd like to obviously say thank you to my co-host Stephen.
A pleasure as always. Thank you for having me.
And this is Edward Jones. Sign off another edition. I'm wishing you all a good night.
Hey! 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 昨日の恋は忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。月が砕け散っても星が燃えて落ちても、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。胸に刺さった恋の刃が燃える思いを狂わすのさ。昨日の恋は忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。